Lost Horizon by James Hilton. Jeffrey Matthews reads the first of 10 episodes.
It's not surprising, I suppose, when I happened to have dinner with my old friend Rutherford recently, that our conversation should turn to Glory Conway. We'd known him at school, and Rutherford had continued the friendship at Oxford. Conway was one of the most remarkable men either of us had ever known. He was certainly outstanding as a youth. He was tall, extremely good-looking, excelled at games and academically. A rather sentimental schoolmaster once referred to his exploits as glorious, and from that arose his nickname. He'd had a brilliant career at Oxford, had served throughout the war, and had later joined the consular service. Then, a year or so before my meeting with Rutherford, I'd heard a rumor that Conway had been killed in an air crash. "I suppose you don't know the details about his death," I said.
"His death?" said Rutherford. "Who told you he was dead? He was very much alive a few months ago."
"Are you sure of that?" I said. "How do you know?"
"Because I travelled with him from Shanghai to Honolulu last November." He refilled my glass and offered me another cigar. "It happened this way. I was in the Far East in the autumn. I was on a train. I happened to get into conversation with a very charming Mother Superior. She was travelling to her convent, and because I spoke a little French, she seemed to enjoy chattering to me about her work and affairs in general. But while we talked, she chanced to mention a fever case that had been admitted to the mission hospital some weeks back. A man they thought must be a European. Although he was in Chinese clothes of the poorest kind, could give no account of himself and had no papers. Well, in the end, she invited me to visit the mission and meet this mysterious stranger. Well, to cut a long story short, I did so. And the Mother Superior, the resident doctor, took me across to the hospital. The place was spotlessly clean, and as we walked past the beds, the doctor explained the cases. When at last we got to our mystery patient, all I could see was the back of the man's head. He was apparently asleep. The Mother Superior told me to speak to him in English, so I said, "Good afternoon," which was the first thing I could think of. Well, the man looked up and replied, "Good afternoon." I recognized him at once, despite his beard and the fact that he was very changed, that it was years since I'd seen him. He was Conway. Of course, when I told the doctor and the Mother Superior that I knew the man, they were pretty excited. But though I called out Conway's name and told him my own, he looked at me without any sign of recognition whatsoever. It was clear that he'd completely lost his memory.
Rutherford went on to tell me that in the end he stayed there over a fortnight, hoping that somehow or other he might induce Conway to remember things. He didn't succeed, but Conway regained his physical health, and they talked a good deal. He was quite cheerful, in a vague sort of way, seemed glad enough to have company. To the suggestion that Rutherford should take him home, he simply said that he didn't mind. So passages were arranged for both of them on a liner leaving for San Francisco.
"As you can imagine, my dear fellow," said Rutherford, "we remade our old friendship on the boat. I told him as much as I knew about him, and he listened to it all very closely. I think he was trying desperately to rediscover himself."
Rutherford leaned over and offered to fill my glass again, but I shook my head. Conway's strange history had completely absorbed my attention.
"Go on," I said. "What happened next?" "Well, at Yokohama, the ship filled up, and among the new passengers was Seafking, a pianist, en route for a concert tour in the States. And a few days out from Japan, Seafking was prevailed upon to give a piano recital on board. Well, of course, Conway and I went to hear him. He played very well. Some Brahms and Scarlatti and a lot of Chopin. Then he left the piano, and he was just going to the door when Conway sat down at the keyboard and was playing some rapid, lively piece I didn't recognize. But it drew Seafking back like a shot.
Mr. Conley, you must tell me what that was you were playing.
Well, Conway made what appeared to be a tremendous mental effort to remember. I think it's a Chopin study, he said.
My dear Mr. Conway, I can tell you positively that it isn't. I know everything of Chopin's that exists, and I can assure you that he never wrote what you have just played. He might well have done so because it is utterly in his style, but he just didn't. I challenge you to show me the score in any of the editions.
Oh, yes. I remember now. It was never printed. I only know it myself from meeting a man who used to be one of Chopin's pupils. Rutherford looked at me to see my reaction.
Good heavens, I said. But Chopin died in 1849.
Exactly. The whole incident was quite extraordinary, but there was still the music to be explained. If it wasn't what Conway said it was, then what was it? Anyway, that night, the night after the recital, Conway got back his memory. We had both gone to bed, and I was lying awake when he came into my cabin and told me. He said he could call everything to mind. He said he wanted to tell me the whole story. It was mid-morning and hot sunshine when he had finished, and during the next 24 hours he filled in a good many gaps. About the middle of the following night, the ship was due to reach Honolulu. He had drinks in my cabin the evening before. He left me about 10 o'clock, and I never saw him again. 3 months later, he wrote to me from Bangkok. He said he was about to set out on a long journey. And that was all. I've heard nothing since. But quite soon after Conway left the ship, I started making notes. Later, as certain aspects of the thing began to grip me, I had the urge to do more, to fashion the written fragments into a single narrative. And by that, I don't mean that I invented or altered anything. There was quite enough material in what he told me.
Rutherford went to an attaché case and took out a bundle of typed manuscript.
Here it is. You can make what you like of it.
And this is the story as I learned it from Rutherford's typescript. The story of Hugh Conway and the Valley of Lost Horizon. It began in May 1931. The situation in Baskul had become much worse, and on the 20th, aircraft arrived to evacuate the white residents. These numbered about 80, and most were safely transported across the mountains in troop carriers to Peshawar. A few miscellaneous aircraft were also employed. In one of these, at about 10 a.m., 4 passengers embarked. Miss Roberta Brinklow, a missionary originally from London, Henry D. Barnard, an American citizen, Hugh Conway, and Captain Charles Mallinson, both of the consular service. Conway was 37. He was tall, deeply bronzed, with slate-blue eyes. That day he was tired. He'd been packing and destroying documents throughout the whole of the day and night preceding the evacuation, so he spread himself indulgently in the well-sprung seat and settled back to doze. It was after the flight had lasted more than an hour that Mallinson, his junior, said he thought the pilot wasn't keeping a straight course. Mallinson sat immediately in front. He was in his middle 20s, pink-cheeked, intelligent, without being intellectual. Conway opened his eyes drowsily and said that whatever the course taken, the pilot presumably knew best. Half an hour later, when weariness and the drone of the engines had lulled him nearly to sleep, Mallinson disturbed him again.
Say, Conway, I thought Fanner was piloting us.
Well, isn't he?
The chap turned his head just now. I'll swear it wasn't Fanner.
Oh, it's hard to tell through that glass panel.
But I'd know Fanner's face anywhere, Conway.
Well, then, it must be somebody else. I don't see that it matters. When we arrive in Peshawar very soon, you can make the fellow's acquaintance and ask him all about himself.
But at this rate, Conway, we shan't get to Peshawar at all. The man, whoever he is right off his course.
Suddenly, the plane lurched slightly and began to descend. Mallinson rose abruptly, and in doing so he bumped his head against the roof and woke Barnard, the American, who had been dozing in his seat at the other side of the narrow gangway. Mallinson peered through the window.
"Great Scott! Look down there!"
Conway looked. The view was certainly not what he'd expected, if indeed he'd expected anything. Instead of trim, geometrically laid-out hangars, nothing was visible but an opaque mist, veiling an immense sun-browned desolation. Long corrugated mountain ridges could be picked out in the distance. Not wishing to alarm the others, Conway leaned over and spoke in Mallinson's ear. "I don't recognize this part of the world. Looks as though you're right. Man has lost his way." The plane was swooping down at a tremendous speed, and as it did so, the air grew hotter. The scorched earth blows like an oven with a door suddenly opened. The American half rose in his seat. "Looks like he wants to land," he said.
"But he can't," said Mallinson. "He'd be simply mad if he tried to. He'll crash. He'll crash."
But the pilot did land. A small cleared space opened by the side of a gully, and with considerable skill, the machine was jolted and heaved to a standstill. What happened after that, however, was even more puzzling. A swarm of bearded tribesmen came forward from all directions. They blocked the cabin entrance and prevented anybody from getting out except the pilot. Meanwhile, cans of petrol were fetched from a dump close by and emptied into the tanks. Grins and shouting met the cries of the four imprisoned passengers, and the slightest attempt to get out provoked a menacing movement from a score of rifles. The midday sun, blazing on the roof of the cabin, grilled the air inside till the occupants were almost fainting with the heat. And when the tanks were at last screwed up, the pilot climbed back into the cockpit, one of the tribesmen swung the propellers, and the plane jolted forward. It rose high into the haze, then turned east, as if setting a course. A handful of passengers sat staring at each other, struck dumb with amazement. It was scarcely possible, but it had happened. A score of unanswered questions hung almost tangibly in the air about them. Who was the pilot? Why were they being kidnapped? And where was he taking them? Above all, where was he taking them?
That was episode 1 of Lost Horizon by James Hilton. It was read by Geoffrey Matthews.